Hello, and thanks for joining us on the podcast that discusses all things gaming. Coming to you from the home of Gen Con and the gaming capital of the world, this is The Established Facts.
Yes, I know, Don. It's a subjective term. Fine, you can go ahead now, Mike.
Gee, thanks.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Established Facts. I'd like to welcome you to the very special recorded at Gen Con episode, and we are joined with some special guests, and we will let them introduce themselves. I don't even think that I have the honor to do so, so we'll send it down to the other end of the table.
Wow, we get to do our own introduction.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Tracy Hickman. I have written a few novels in my time and made up a few games in my time. And I am also the writer and the editor of the very first science fiction movie actually made in space.
What?
That's true. Hi, I'm Laura Hickman, and I've been here for this wonderful journey with him, and I've gotten to write a bunch of novels with him and a bunch of the games, and we just have a great time, and my DNA is actually floating around on the International Space Station.
Oh, wicked.
Okay, so, Mike, I don't know if you had the opportunity to listen to the Genisodes last podcast, but Tracy had a story to tell about being in space. What are you talking about? You filmed a science fiction thing actually in space.
I am the writer and the editor of the first science fiction movie actually made in space. Actually, it's been recently, it was the Smithsonian has requested a copy of it for their archives.
Really?
Yeah, really.
it's true.
I think he's lying.
Tell them the title.
The title of this epic motion picture is Apogee of Fear. Ooh. Yeah, woo. Yeah. Richard Garriott, who created the Ultima series and became one of the great pioneers, actually, in role-playing games online and in computer gaming.
And is now doing Shroud of the Avatar.
Based on the Kickstarter that he did... was it earlier this year?
Yeah,
earlier this year that I helped with. And in fact, I happen to be the lead story designer now for Shroud of the Avatar, and I'm doing the story creation for Richard Garriott's game that's coming out. And he's probably wondering why I'm here at Gen Con instead of busy putting together the story as I said I was supposed to be doing.
Advertising.
Yeah, advertising. So Richard Garriott, a few years back, I've known Richard for some time. He's been a good friend. And I called him up and said, he said, well, it's been a while. I said, yeah. He said, what are you up to? I said, well, I'm writing some books and stuff. And I said, what are you up to? And he said, well, I'm going to the International Space Station for 10 days. And I couldn't really one-up that. So it turns out that Richard Garriott's father was, in fact, an Apollo-era astronaut. Wow. And was one of the astronauts on Skylab. And
explains a lot.
And Richard grew up, actually, in Houston and with, astronauts. We're all up and down the street, and if you weren't an astronaut, you were either part of an astronaut's family or were a rocket scientist. I mean, that was just the reality of his growing up. And he always wanted to go into space, follow his father and go into space. But when he was very, very young, a NASA doctor told him, kid, with your eyes, you're never, ever, ever going to go to space. So Richard decided he wanted to go to space anyway. became one of the pioneers in gaming, and did really well financially, and decided to find out what it would cost to just buy a ticket to go into space. And they went to NASA to ask this question, and that's not a question you ask NASA. They just said, no, we can't sell people like seats like they were going to New Jersey. We can't do that. So they decided to ask the Russians. And when they asked the Russians said, it would cost us so much money to find out how much money it would cost. We can't even do the study. So Richard personally funded that study and found out how much money it was going to take. And in fact was going to be the first civilian to fly into space with the Russians. But it was about that same time that the dot-com bubble burst and he lost all of the funding he had set aside to make the trip. And so the trip was made by somebody else while Richard watched. The end of that story was that he finally made the money back and made the investment and was going to fly to the space station. Well, Laura and I had created something we called PartyFlix and had sent him a prototype many, many years ago, and it was a party game where you would actually film a movie during the party. You'd get all your friends together, and it was all assemble edit, so you'd all, you know, sequence one after the other, and you'd show them the cue cards. Just they had no rehearsal whatsoever. They had to read it cold, and you'd film it, and then just keep going.
I want to play.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, it was wonderful.
You do.
You really do. It's a lot of fun.
It's hilarious.
And then and the original we had done was called Rocket Ship XM, I think is what it was called. XL. Rocket Ship XL, extra large. And it was great because we already had pre-filmed the opening segment, and then we would like convert our kitchen into like the control room for the spacecraft, you know, put panels up on all of the cupboards, and we'd use the little hose for a microphone. And then in the middle of all of this, we had all of these really cheesy special effects, like a little model of the rocket on a black piece of cloth on the floor, and we pull it with a string and film it from up above, right?
It's like Star Wars.
And like throw aluminum foil things at it. And we film all this in real time, right? And so it was a lot of fun. Well, he thought this was really great, so he said, hey, you remember that party flick thing you showed us? And I said, yeah. He said, could I do that on the International Space Station? Is there a way to do that? And,
man,
you know, when somebody asks you a question like that, you say, sure.
Yes.
So we did. What Laura and I did, actually, is we built a party flick for the ISS. And we couldn't do anything with any weight, right? So we built the whole thing in a PowerPoint presentation. All of the cue cards were on this PowerPoint presentation, right? And all of the directions, all the shot setups were all laid out for Richard in advance. We even translated all of the lines into Russian and Cyrillic Russian.
Wow.
So that the cosmonauts could read their lines and know what they were saying, right? And then we figured we'd like do subtitles, right? He thought this was a great idea. And so all he had to do was to previously upload the PowerPoint file to his memory disk that he was taking up, right? Mm-hmm. And then once he got up there, he had a laptop that he could display it on. At the space station, you just like leave the laptop floating here with the lines on it, right? And film the guys shooting it. So he...
that image is just nuts.
I could just visualize a laptop just hovering.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And it's got like, you know, it's got lines on it, you know, like
cue cards.
Like cue cards. Yeah, exactly.
Does it also have the stage directions, or do you...
It did. It also gave stage directions for Richard, so that it gave framing directions so that he would know where to frame the camera, which angle to shoot from, so that it had like
so
cross
brilliant.
Angles
wow.
and so forth. Well, he went and we wrote it specifically for the entire crew of the ISS, which included three Russian cosmonauts, two American astronauts, and Richard. When he got to the ISS, rode up on a Soyuz space capsule launched from Kazakhstan. And I just recently saw the interior of a Soyuz
last week. It's so small. It's so small. You'd feel like you'd get in there and you'd be like scratching at the door to get out in about 15 minutes.
It's a very small.
I don't know how.
Is
he
it
spent.
Like a coffin or something?
Well, it's if you take three chairs, mm-hmm. and lay them down on the floor, right? But you have to angle and cross the legs, so because all of their feet are like side by side.
Oh.
In like a fan.
They're really friendly.
Yeah, they're very, very friendly.
Plus, it's a short trip.
Oh no!
It's 24 hours to catch the ISS.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So you know, and well, the Soyuz is just a really interesting spacecraft. I'm not sure I'd want to get in. There's actually the escape hatch is like forward and up above. It's very difficult to get to. He flew up on the Soyuz to the International Space Station. We got to the International Space Station. He approached the crew on board the ISS, the Russian crew and the American crew, and asked them if they'd be interested in doing it. And they said, well, yeah, sounds like fun.
What else are they going to do?
We've got nothing else to do
over here. Two of the cosmonauts actually bowed out of the project. For an unusual reason, but I can't really go into it. It was actually a personal reason and a question of just their being comfortable. But one of the Russians thought this sounded like a lot of fun, and the two American astronauts thought this was sounded like a lot of fun. So Richard actually reworked the script slightly to deal with the two and filmed it. And of course, it couldn't impact anyone's schedule, so it all had to be done in their downtime. But because everything was all set up, they could just shoot it and move on. 10 days later, Richard landed on the Great Kazakhstan plane in another different Soyuz spacecraft. He said it's kind of like a controlled train wreck. The Soyuz system has parachutes deployed coming down toward the Kazakhstan plane, and when they're, I think he said, 20 feet above the ground, a whole cycle of rockets fire to hopefully slow them down enough so that they don't punch a really big hole in the Kazakhstan plane.
Hopefully being the key word,
although they do anyway. And,
right.
But so anyway, he landed in the landed with that Soyuz. They put him on the helicopter, took him to an airbase, got on a jet, flew him to Star City, Russia, where his quarters were located. And as soon as he got back to his room, he uploaded all the footage to the server, and I downloaded it into my computer in Utah. And we immediately did the edit. And that produced Apogee of Fear. That's the story.
And tell them how long the entire film is.
The entire film, actually, including the opening credits and the fake preview that we stuck at the beginning, is like far less time than it's taken to explain this. It's very, very short for a film. But you can see it now on YouTube, I believe.
And the Russian, bless his heart.
Oh, bless him. He was wonderful.
He did all of his lines in English, but we still had to use the subtitles.
But he was so proud of doing it.
He did a really good job
and was really into it. It's a charming little film. But it is, in fact, the first science fiction movie made in space.
You have to remember, it was acted by astronauts.
Yes,
generally actors.
We actually, one of the astronauts was Mike Fink, Colonel Mike Fink, and who I just recently found out holds the American record for longest time in space, period. I mean, he's been in space longer than any other American. But he was one of the astronauts that was in it. We just saw him recently
in Houston
and while we were on a tour of the Houston Manned Spacecraft Center, and got to remind him of the fact that he is, in fact, a star of this epic. We did that reminding actually on a tour with Robert Picardo, who played the Doctor on Voyager, and so he asked Mike if he was a member of SAG. Mike wasn't sure that SAG's jurisdiction extended that far. But anyway, yes, we are. Yes, in fact, we are the writers and the editors of the first science fiction movie actually made in in space.
And we will have a link to that on the episode.
Yes, I will put the YouTube link.
Oh yes,
to the
please. And
Apogee of Fear.
Apogee
in our
of
show
Fear.
Notes.
It is not great cinema, but it is historic.
Now this, the device that you use, I forget what you call it again.
Camera.
No, the
oh
the
memory card.
The cue cards and all that you
yeah.
put together.
Laptop.
Josh?
I am so glad that I'm farthest away from you right now.
It's throwing distance. We know how this works.
Yeah, no. I thought you created an actual, like...
No, one of the constraints we had actually was that we had to not take up any weight at all, and we couldn't impact the schedule at all.
It was a PowerPoint.
So we did it as a PowerPoint presentation and simply uploaded it as a PowerPoint, yeah.
Because it would sound like it would be a fun thing just to do.
Oh, we've done it as, like, flip cards
flip
in a binder.
Cards, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
that'd be a lot of fun just for, like, party games and stuff like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Every one of our kids did it for their 16th birthday.
Oh,
yeah. We have a succession of versions of the Rocket Ship XL film, each one a little bit crazier than the last. We've done it for adult parties too, and people just really enjoy it.
Yeah, I'd love to see that, like, release. So
it's
like...
fascinating also to see how people change when you put a camera in front of them.
Oh yeah.
Imagine what it was like putting you behind the mic the first time.
I know. I can't imagine how it was.
Oh man.
And it is also true that a copy of our DNA is in orbit on the International Space Station. Both Laura and I, our DNA is up there, you know. So I guess if
we're part of an experiment,
yeah. if aliens come along, if Earth is wiped out, aliens come along, find the DNA, figure out what the DNA means, actually manage to do the sequence and reproduce the human race, they'll apparently look like us.
And hopefully, gaming will live on.
And gaming will live on.
Everything's okay.
Yeah.
So see, I couldn't have done a better intro than that right there.
I know. Is the show over now?
Clocking out. But no, we wanted to just kind of talk. We had a Dr. Deb, which is she's not with us on the show
she's
tonight.
Not with us anymore.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That is not nice.
Now wait a minute. I didn't go there. She's not with us on the show, and she. Brought up the topic of how you keep players engaged in what's going on. And I know a lot of us play lots of games, be it role-playing games or just, you know, idle card games, any type of, the, you know, party game. How do you keep people just interested in what's going on, you know, if there's, you know, 10, 12 people versus 4 people, do those things change? You know, how do you keep all these people interested in what's going on? She was really interested in what... you had to say about that in particular, and of course we're just a bunch of opinionated people, and I'm sure we have all kinds of things to say about it,
which are all true.
And I was going to say
none of them are probably true.
Start a game with a story like that.
It's true.
You can't start a game with a story that is a game about a game.
But I think the point is that you need to have engaging stories. That's how you keep people interested, because without the story, then people just check out because there's more interesting things to deal with, like on your phone or your iPad or your Kindle and stuff like that.
You mentioned that because we're actually doing a game that uses iPads and Kindles, a board game that uses iPads and Kindles.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like I said, iPads and Kindles are wonderful tools.
There are more interesting things to do.
That's right.
Yes.
You're going to have steep competition.
Well, see, in that case, then it's actually you're not getting distracted because you're having to deal with whatever the game brings up on the iPad or Kindle.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the device of the game itself. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not like you're going and Facebooking or something like that.
I think it's really important to get a snapshot of what kind of players you're playing with, because you're going to have people who are fascinated by the story. You're going to have people who are fascinated by objective. You're going to have people who are social players who just want to interact with the other players. And you need to get a snapshot of who, as a game master, you're playing to. So that you can keep those individuals engaged.
That'd be difficult with all those if you have all those at the same table.
Well, it happens.
It happens. Yeah. So, and there's a technique that we talk about in our SDM book that deals with that, which we call juggling. That you have to juggle the emphasis of what's going on. You always have to provide something that is of interest to the player. As Laura mentioned, there's basically three kinds of players. There's a fighter player. If it moves, kill it. If it doesn't move, kick it till it moves. Take its stuff and buy bigger weapons to kill bigger things and take bigger stuff. Mm-hmm. That's a combat-oriented player is that way. A social player, if it moves, talk to it. If it doesn't move, talk about it. Mm. Always speak in an affected voice and get in character no matter what. If you have an entire table full of these social types of players, put them in an inn, get them talking to each other in character, go out for pizza. You can come back and they'll still be there and perfectly happy.
Why can't I have those players?
Have you been in our Star Wars campaign? That's all we do.
You would end up with pizza, us calling you because the inn's on fire, and we've killed the bartender.
But that's a different problem, actually.
Then you would set up your own business, making about $30 million a day.
Right.
See,
that sounds like us.
And we'd be emperors of the continents.
That's true.
Yeah. The whole point is that you have to change that emphasis. You have to be able to read the players. You're not going to have a full table full of the same kind of players. And if you have, especially if you have a lot of players, I have to, well, to a certain extent, we deal with that in Killer Breakfast every time we run one of these shows. Because every time there's a new table full of characters at the table, each one has a new strength. Each one has a new weakness, and each one plays differently. And so you have to be, as a referee in a game like that, you have to be very nimble in order to read the player to know where their interest is and how to tap into that and shifting the emphasis in the game to tap into that. If you've got a classic, very simple example of that, if you've got the fight, if you look over and you see your fighter players are getting bored, then oh, wow, the gypsies attack from the woods. Okay, let's get the swords out and beat on gypsies, because that's okay. We can beat on gypsies. In this particular world, anybody can beat on a gypsy, and it's not going to be a big deal. So we're going to beat on the gypsies here, and that's fine. The combat's running just fine for the fighter players, and they're happy with that. But the social players, they're kind of getting nervous and playing with the dice a little bit, and so, okay, we've killed the gypsies, except for one who is gravely wounded, whom we can talk to.
Or about.
Well, you can talk about the dead ones. You can talk to the one who is not dead.
Oh, look at that wound.
And all
terrible.
Of a sudden, we hear about the terrible plight of the gypsies and why they're attacking us, because they're being forced to do so by the great... And as this particular tale starts to spin out, then the fighters are still pretty happy because they're still cleaning their swords. But but the third kind of player is the type A player. It's the objective-oriented player. They want to know how to win the game, as though you could.
It's a game of points where the points don't matter.
Exactly.
Exactly. And in fact, but nevertheless, they want to know that they have been making progress toward a tangible goal, so that they can see forward motion in terms of winning and growth. So for those players, you need objectives. That they
is that
have
also
to
level people that are concerned about leveling.
No, leveling is a completely different issue, at least in my head. Mm-hmm. Although leveling feeds into that to a certain extent, I think we've all become level junkies, and I think that levels, in the XDM game system that we developed, you can in fact get levels, but it makes absolutely no difference to the character whatsoever.
Why heck?
Oh, I'm sorry. I know. I gave you a level.
No. It's just that I made past level 60 on Candy Crush Saga today, and I was so proud of myself, and now I feel like it's nothing.
But that's Candy Crush. That's a special.
That's a special exception to this particular rule, sweetheart.
It's unbelievable how many people I know are playing Candy Crush.
I've seen it, but I'm not really sure exactly what it is. It looks like a type of Bejeweled type game.
It's a Bejeweled kind of game with a certain saccharine overtone.
It's really addictive. There was, like, on the plane, there were people, like, four rows. And they were all playing Candy Crush Saga. I'm like, oh, what level are you on?
My coworker John's huge into that, and I wish he was here because he'd be able to go on about that.
How did we get to this from a serious discussion?
I think the question should be, how do you keep your podcasters engaged to what's going on?
That's right. And in fact, if we were looking and examining the audience right now, are they playing with their dice or are they deeply engaged?
They're objective oriented.
Oh, well. Then we need to tell them where all of this is going.
Yeah, like someone think of an objective.
Yeah, you win. Turn it off. Wow.
Yeah.
They're waiting for the fact.
You know, it's usually a little early for that.
Usually it's my job to keep everyone, kind of held together. Obviously that's failing.
Well, you've been away for a while.
Well, that's not true.
He was on the last episode.
She was away for a while before that, though.
You're mixing him up with me, because I was gone for the last two.
And that's just me.
I think I've been gone for the last 24 episodes.
So I'm kind of interested in the concept you were talking about. You think that leveling has become kind of like a like its own enigma. Like, you know, that people get obsessed with leveling up characters and stuff like that. Like, can you kind of explain what you like? How you feel like you've come to that conclusion? Like, have you just through your own experiences watching people get wrapped up in that? I mean,
it's so gamey.
Yeah.
I mean, it has no real... It barely has any connection with reality whatsoever. One of the games that I played early on was Traveller. And the thing about Traveller, which we also called Accountants in Space...
yes.
There was a man's game for you because you could die in character creation.
Wow.
That's what I'm talking about, a game.
I still want to go through Traveller character creation.
I liked that. And the fact of the matter is, the reason that I liked the game mostly was because when you started playing the game, and were playing the game, no matter how wealthy you were, no matter how long you've been playing the game, no matter how cool your character was and many great things that they had done, if somebody put a rifle to your head, you died. Which made perfect sense to me. So, you know, the idea that you can level up and become this tank-like character, you know, where little, you know, minions are throwing rocks at you and you just kind of, they bounce off like you're Superman. If you're going to play a superhero, I guess that's fine. Superman has his own problems, and we can go into that some other time. But the fact is, I think that levels do a disservice to role-playing because they teach us that you can become invincible. And I think that that's... In terms of what it teaches the gamer about life is actually a harmful thing.
But wouldn't it be an escape, though? I mean, how gritty, how realistic do you...
Oh, well, no one wants to get gritty or realistic. I mean, we're supposed to be having fun, right?
It's the aspect of conveyance. What are you teaching? Well, as you're playing the game, you know, you encounter some kind of a challenge. You can introduce them to those things gradually. Like, there's a bad guy coming along, and right before it gets to you, it'll drop. And then in the very, very next instance, what you do is jump on a platform and the platform starts falling underneath you. And then you introduce those things together. You're learning that aspect through conveyance.
And part of the problem I see in this, I very recently, for reasons that I don't recall at the moment, we watched Salt. Angelina Jolie movie. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, because our son sent it home with us.
That's right, because
we
our son sent
it.
Angelina Jolie home with us. And so...
What?
So, of course, we watched.
And it turned into a fun weekend.
So I'm watching this movie, and she, like... leaps out through like this window and onto the top of a moving train, and then from a moving train four stories into the back of like a truck, and I'm thinking, she is so dead.
That's a standard.
I'm sorry, we're talking like, you know, broken legs here, internal hemorrhaging. I mean, there's any number of ways that this could kill her and should have. But we have, I mean, it's fun to pretend that.
Harm her.
Yeah, at least harm, couldn't she,
well,
like,
it's
couldn't
like
her hair be upset?
You just have to say, oh, this is a Wile E. Coyote minute, you know? You just have to know that about those things.
Well, Wile E. Coyote at least got, like, smushed by rocks. And...
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I think one thing it brings up is something that I can relate to. Jeremy, I think, can definitely relate to as well. And then something I've also heard is that, you know, the American martial arts society, if you will, in its universal sense, one thing that they had to start doing was to give students the initiative to continue their lessons. They adopted a belt system, which is exactly the same as a leveling system. Because in the actual Asian martial arts and the actual study of Kung Fu and Karate and Taekwondo in their homelands, there is no belt system. It is practical application, and once you know this part, you move to the next part. And it's just a continual learning of the art that you are practicing. Whereas in America, they have to put some sort of incentive in front of you. Oh, well, now that you know this, so that you'll continue to learn more things, we're going to give you a belt.
Well, that comes back to the whole idea of progress.
Right.
The measurable progress.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to want, especially I think in the United States, we want to see this. Laura and I, a few years back, went to Australia. To Brisbane, to Gen Con Australia. And when we arrived there, a day early, and when we arrived there, it was right in the middle of the rugby playoffs. Now, I had not been terribly familiar with rugby, certainly not Australian rugby. And so we thought, Laura and I, as we had time there and were trying to recover our jet lag from flying to Australia, that we should watch Australian rugby and figure out the game, because we're game designers. We should be able to work this out.
And logical idea.
We're watching the game, and they never stop.
Yeah.
They just keep running, and the ball go, and they keep going, and they keep going, and they don't stop or do anything. They just keep going. And then the guy ran all the way down, and it got down to the end where it looked like a goalpost to me. So I figured that was, you know, I'm an American. A goal, we can go there. Okay, fine. And so he's struggling, and he's pushing against the other team, and he's right at the boundary line of the goal line there, and up on the screen it flashes try, no try, and then a few moments later it said no try, and I thought, yes he did, he tried really hard. That is so upsetting to me that they would like embarrass him in front of the whole stadium full of people saying he didn't try hard enough. So
do or do not, there is no try.
That's right.
So we have no concept of how this game is played, but the more we watched it, the cooler it got. Yeah. I mean, these guys are out here just really going at each other, and we're talking, you know, like shorts and socks and no helmets here.
It's rugby.
So we're asking Australians about this, and they had a wonderful observation for us. They said, oh, well, that's because you were raised on American football. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, American football is like America. You get this armor on, as much armor as you can possibly put on. And then you all go up to a line, and then you crash into each other. And when it doesn't work, you stop, and you go and you have a meeting. And then you try it again. And that's America. Okay, I could see that, actually. So, the reason, coming back to leveling, the reason that I thought of that is because rugby, you know, it was this this confused, wonderful dance that took place without any breaks, and you had an objective to reach, but it was all this wonderful moving dance that took place continuously on the field that American football is try it, stop.
To check your progress.
Check your progress.
Yes.
Try it, stop, check your progress. And so it's almost as though leveling itself is part of the American psyche in that sense.
Yeah, it's very analytical, and I think that we're...
And I think we get stuck in that idea. The problem with role-playing games, as far as I'm concerned, is that the leveling system doesn't even reflect the kind of progress that you're talking about when you're talking about belt progress in martial arts. Mm-hmm. Belt progress in martial arts is a measuring of progress through different forms and different techniques. Leveling in role-playing games just beefs you up.
It's like a gratification.
Yeah, and for me it's very artificial, and because it's so artificial and because leveling has a tendency to be so buffing too quickly and from where you can get to from where you started, is there's such a huge difference that it actually teaches the wrong thing, that it actually teaches that we can become invincible.
Well, one thing I was basically just observing was that if you think about it, belts in martial arts are representation of knowledge. As you have reached that point of knowledge in your craft, where leveling in RPG games typically is an enhancement of your character from that point forward. So it's complete opposite ends of a single spectrum, because if you think of a single level or belt in a system, you're looking at one receiving because you know it at the end. Where one and the other one is you gain it, and that is you're continuing through that. So it's really two complete ends of that.
Leveling is a reward system. The belt system is an acknowledgement system. You've reached the point, here's a belt. Leveling is you've done enough, now you can do some more.
Yeah, that could well be. I hadn't actually thought of it in those particular terms, but mm-hmm. I think that certainly could be.
It's a vast cultural difference between, I mean, we've been talking about martial arts, between East and West, in that in Asia, in Japan, China, all that, it's martial arts can be viewed as art, really. It's mm-hmm. I mean, oh, it's called martial arts, but I mean, it can be viewed as dance, and it's very symbolic, very the movement is just beautiful and graceful. Translating it here is very difficult because we don't, and I'm going to make a very broad generalization, Americans think very literal in terms of they try to analyze everything, and we try to analyze a lot. Mm-hmm. So the concept of, okay, we do all these movements, well, why are you doing all those movements? Well, that just, it translates into Angelina Jolie and Salt going, I'm now invincible because I can do these things.
I think that's true. I think, too, as in practicality, in terms of role-playing games, as we talk about role-playing games, and we're relating it to role-playing games and as well as other things, there's a disconnect between strength, agility, statistics, and wisdom, intelligence, charisma, statistics, right? I mean, if I have a character and it's got an intelligence of 3, mm-hmm. right? You know, and Yeah, yeah, my DM is not going to come to me and say, I'm sorry, you are too stupid to open the door. But I want to open the door. I'm sorry, your character is too stupid to open the door. I want you to roll the save to open the door. And there's that disconnect. You know, if you have a puzzle that's inside of a game or a riddle that's inside of a game, yeah, you're not actually going to judge the riddle based on the ability of the player to solve the riddle based on his intelligence and wisdom dexterities of his... of his character. And so those, so when we talk about leveling, we're not actually talking about an increase of knowledge. We're talking almost entirely about beating stuff up.
Oh, yes.
I think an issue that comes with the leveling is not just from role-playing games. Sorry. I am both the princess and the frog today. I think it comes from gaming in general with the growth of online MMORPGs. To keep players interested, like Josh said, leveling becomes a reward system. Like, beat up X number of bad guys, you get XP, and you can buy more stuff to beat up more bad guys with XP. And I think that's trickled down into other forms of gaming. People expect the same kinds of, like, if you beat up this many monsters, you get a cool weapon, or if you beat up this many guys then you get this level and you get these new powers, and it's not really a progression of your character, it's just I want more things.
Like, it's a disconnect between types of gaming, whether it's strategic or whether it's for the story itself.
But but MMORPGs took that from D&D.
Yep.
When from MUDs when that happened. And I tell you, I once went into WoW. And I was first.
That was fun.
Oh, golly gee.
Did you make it to level 12?
No.
Yeah. That's usually where I
quit. I'm in WoW, and of course, I am in here beating up rats and, you know, I don't know, hamsters, whatever it was that you're supposed to do at level zero to try to get someplace. But the moment that sticks in my mind is I had gained a few levels and I branched out enough so that I could get killed regularly. And, but I was on a road. And I had my little rusty sword and, you know, and my little wooden shield that I'd, like, crafted and was wearing my, you know, leotard, whatever it was I had. And down the road came this super player.
Oh no.
Yeah. Who was, you know, riding by, and he was like on the back of his saber-toothed tiger
dinosaur
and had his wearing his armor of impervious to everything, and his
gold and shiny.
Yeah, shiny, and he had his flaming sword as he rode past, and I remember standing there on the road as a character watching this go by. And, of course, I was, you know, I was a hamster to this guy. He paid no more attention to me than he would have to, like, the farmer's pig in the field. And I remember thinking, I'm leaving. As I watched this guy ride by, I thought of all the time and money that represented riding by me, and I thought, I don't want to go there. And I never came back to the game.
I think of the main MMORPG that I play, EVE Online. And I think about how, like, some of these various things take into effect in that game. And while the game doesn't have a traditional leveling system, you gain experience over time. You apply that experience to skills. Mm-hmm. There is no set levels. So you're gaining your measure, like your leveling system would be just a classification of just how many overall skill points you have. And I think about how that system is, and yeah, it is. You really are that time crunch, because it is a game that is based on real-time of learning of skills. So somebody who has been in the game for 10 years, if you join the game today, if they continue to play, you'll never catch them. It's not possible. But it's just, I just think of that, as you say, it's just, it's a complete time waste. But I say time waste, and it's really not a time waste. Because really, why do we play games? To disassociate ourselves from the real world for a period of time for our enjoyment. And that's what a game truly is. And it's just kind of an entertaining thinking about how various types of achievement in leveling systems play into various different styles of gaming. And it's the only thing I can see of in this instance that it plays in there is Eve has a certificate system. Where you can, it's almost like the belt system from a martial arts system. You gain a certificate based on what you have learned already up to that point, not gaining levels based on so you can do more.
But aren't we nevertheless still talking about that measurable progress? Mm-hmm.
Yes. It is completely measurable.
We have to give
progress.
You something that is going to measure that progress.
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking that's what League of Legends is.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the truth is, my son, who plays a lot, really enjoys it, but he's had to improve. He's had to learn to play the different characters, the aspects of the different characters, and to play those characters according to who else is playing in the game, too. Mm-hmm. And so he's had
Where's
to learn.
Is he ranked now?
Oh, my goodness. Can I brag?
Mm-hmm. Please.
Go, please.
By all means.
He just made platinum, too. I'm very proud of him, actually.
Oh, yes. I will clap, so we have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, only in my house, of course, would the parents be proud of their son making platinum, too.
Platinum's the highest tier in the ranked matches.
Just below diamond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing quite well.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So,
I don't play LOL, but that sounds awesome. Like,
yes, it is. Your son, it's totally awesome. Be terribly impressed.
I am all those things.
My question is, and kind of tying this back into our original question of how to keep players focused on a game and things like that, is how do you take players who are used to a leveling up system and bring them into a game where they're going to be focused on the story, and they're going to want to continue to upgrade their stats or upgrade their equipment or things like that, but kind of deviating from what the norm is.
Well, this of course is just how I would approach that. I would construct an adventure that had story built into it, that had such personal connection with the characters that were involved, that showed the leveling system to be hollow, that in attaining a new level you did harm to someone, that to attain that level you actually had to hurt somebody to do so, and somebody that you grow to care about.
Derek, you need to not listen to this. Sorry, he's our main game master. He already tears our hearts out.
That information, and
what an interesting idea that is.
And I think of our Gen Con game where we have grown attached to our characters.
Yeah,
where level really doesn't take effect.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't affect.
That's why at Killer Breakfast we always give people characters that have absolutely no connection to them whatsoever. We want them to have somebody that they will not feel really badly about when they die any moment now.
When their inevitable doom.
With their inevitable and preferably rapid doom. Yeah.
So, 200 people to filter through that grinder.
So here's what I consider to be a good story, characters change over time throughout the course of the storyline. How do you reflect that, or do you even want to reflect that at that point? Do they reflect that in just how they play the character then?
One of the... I think you reflect that in how they play the character. I think that's metagame.
Okay.
One of my favorite games, actually, was... Laura and I, of course, did Ravenloft for many years before it was fun.
Oh, thank you.
I do hang love that over their heads. Love I'm it. Like, if you continue this, I'm going to send you to Ravenloft.
It's one of our most hated places in gaming.
Okay, hold on.
It's time for you to hear a gaming story about your own world from another gamer.
So here you go. We played with this game master that she...
she ran a really good version of Ravenloft, and I played a character that I joined the game, and I kind of stopped playing the campaign, and then I came back, and they just so happened to be in Ravenloft when I rejoined the campaign. And so I kind of got, somehow you were forced there, now they're picking you up, and now we have to find a way out, and yada, yada, yada. Yeah, okay. So I kind of just implemented into my character that from this point forward in the game, that ended up lasting like, you know, 6.5 years, that my character had this huge phobia about ending up back in Ravenloft, right? Like, this is, he was not going to end up back there. And
talking
so,
about killing gypsies.
Right. I'm
just saying.
Full circle. But we ended up, later on in the campaign, one of the character's sisters was captured, and I had this crystal ball that would let me see where she was. And so I'm a sorcerer, so I was like, bam, I'll get her. I pulled out this crystal ball. Where is she at? And so it showed me she was tied up to this chair. This house was on fire. And I was like, I'll get her. And I was like, teleport. And she's like, no, it doesn't work. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, whatever, gate. Boom, threw it open. Through the gate I go and grabbed her. And I'm like, all right, it's time to go home. Gate doesn't work. And I'm like, this is bad news. So I'm sitting there, right? And
we're epic level characters. It's like, ridiculous level.
It's
stupid. Power-wise, yeah.
But I'm sitting there, and I just watched her across the room, and she just got this smile on her face, and I was like,
oh God.
And that's that moment that you realize that you were just completely duped by your own GM into completely fulfilling every, you know, bad thing that your character ever wanted.
And that's when a GM says, I win.
So in turn, she didn't believe that I could play out being afraid of being in Ravenloft. So my character went catatonic. So for the next, like, 5 gaming sessions, I sat on their couch literally like this.
For hours.
We're talking games that last 10 to 14 hours.
Sometimes. Yeah, they were.
So I had this little pseudo dragon that was my animal companion, and it took her as a game master convincing me that my pseudo dragon cared enough about him that he was scared that he was going to die to, like, break him out of him being catatonic. But it was so awesome because it was just really awesome because she totally duped me into ended up back there, and I was like, fine. We'll play your game.
Yeah, we'll play it. Yeah. Well, and in fact, that's really the heart of improvisation. You know, never say no.
Absolutely.
No. Just say yes, and then.
And then you move ahead
from there. In the Ravenloft game, one of the Ravenloft games that we played it every Halloween, actually, for about
that's brilliant.
5 years, I think. And but
before
one of the
it was published.
Before it was published, that was one well-tested game. time has seemed to have proven that. one of the games that we played. We had portrayed the story of Strahd so melancholy and with such empathy that when the party finally found him in the crypt they found Strahd weeping over the crypt of Irina Kolyana.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, wow.
And the main character was a paladin, and when he came into the room and saw this, and after having gone through the whole story arc of Strahd and his tragedy, he couldn't do it.
Wow.
He could not attack Strahd.
Wow.
The character behind him had no such compunction, however.
pushed him aside,
and we had this vicious combat that took place after that, wherein Strahd was destroyed. But this player that had decided that could not attack Strahd came to me afterwards, devastated. He said it was like watching an animal be put down, and understanding that why the animal was the way that it was, and it was really devastating for him as a player to go through that. And I thought, what a great
story!
What a great story!
Right? Yes, that's That's an amazing enemy or an amazing
and that
antagonist when you can get that pathos from your players.
Yeah, and when you and that's the kind of thing I think that you aspire to as a DM to be able to provide that kind of experience for the player. That has nothing to do with dice.
No.
And it doesn't have anything to do with rules. That has to do with performance, story, and connection, paying attention to the player.
Yes.
On the counter side of that, it reminded me of, and this is probably a story I've told 1.5 million times, so
you
forgive
have.
Me, I'll keep it quick. But the night before we did our character reset for the epic characters that that we played in Ravenloft, we had this huge battle with this Dracolich named Hades that we were getting ready to walk into. And the night before we went on to this battle, our GM gave us an opportunity. She said, okay, you know, you are in your home, you are with your family, you know, you have wives, you have children, you have friends, they're all here. And it was kind of that last hurrah, like, this is an opportunity for you to kind of role play a character emotionally that you may that you have invested so much time in. What do you want to do? And Michael and I at the time were playing brothers, and we were playing Drow Sorcerer brothers, and we sat down privately and we were like, what do we want to do? Like, we want to make this memorable. And we literally wrote letters to the GM, to our wives, and I think they were probably 2 or 3 pages, and she sat and read them and literally just began to weep because of the amount of care and passion that we had had, not only for her as a GM, because we'd been playing at this point, we'd been playing this game for 3 years, but not only did we have so much passion for her, but we had so much passion for the story and the characters, and we knew, like, this was, at the time, our Strahd. This was the big baddie that we had been chasing and chasing and chasing for 3 years, that had literally been the impetus for the destruction of our main party players' village. Like, the whole reason that this adventure even started was because he had destroyed the village that the very first player in this game had been from. And so it was like, it was just so, we were all so racked with emotion. And of any of the memories that I have from that game, I can still, like, it's so easy for me to remember that night and to remember how much emotion was behind that character. And that's exactly what that reminded me of when you were just talking about Strahd.
You can actually do that in game on the fly. And it's one of the things we talk to people about doing, in fact. Years ago at a Gen Con, actually, I played in a game with, it was run by Peter Atkinson. Troy Denning was at the game. Ed Greenwood was playing in the game. Margaret was playing in the game. Margaret Weiss was playing in the game. I was playing in this game. It was pretty high powered table.
Sounds and like celebrity poker.
It was.
Celebrity D&D.
It was. And at one point, we ended up in the tavern, because that's where you end up. Anyway, so we end up in this tavern, and in the particular backstory that we were given, we were elven warriors just returned from the war, and we had returned home, that this was our home. So we were in this tavern, and the tavern keeper, of course, comes up and wants to get our order here, and I looked at Peter when he asked for the order, and I said, "You remember us, don't you?" And Peter said, "Well, I don't know. I think maybe I said, "Oh, of course you do. You remember us from before. Okay, tell us, when was the first time you saw us?"
Oh, I see.
And he had to make it up.
Yeah.
And whatever he came up with, you know, and if I had to prompt him, I'd say, "Oh, come on. Sure, you remember it was the night we had the fire. You were afraid the place was going to burn down. It wasn't our fault, but you thought it was." You can give him that much and then let him run with it. Because that's, you can go ahead and spark somebody and you go ahead and what it, and it's, it, did it happen? Yes. And then, and move on from there. We did our.
That's like House Sitter for gaming.
Yeah, it's like House Sitter for gaming. Yeah. It goes, if you get a chance, see the movie House Sitter. It's a Steve Martin, Goldie Hawn. It was directed by Frank Oz, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's all about just making up your life as you go along.
Interesting.
And making a and making it interesting, because the story of our normal life isn't, so we might as well make up something interesting. So I would definitely recommend, and Laura's right, I'd definitely recommend that film. We were in Houston and did a killer breakfast in Houston this week, a couple weeks ago. And Laura had to go somewhere and get something, as I recall.
He was sent on an errand.
He was sent on an errand and at the beginning of the game, after we'd done our opening number. And while she was gone, things get completely out of hand.
Of course they do.
Because they do.
And she's gone for like 5 minutes.
But see, I asked... That's all it took.
30 seconds and it's over.
Well, I asked one of the players who they were. And because it was the first table. And I asked one of the players who they were, and they said, "I am JoJo Pony Slayer." And I know that they were just trying to be cute with the Dragon Slayer, Pony Slayer thing, and that was fine. I said, "Pony Slayer." And, of course, in a very short order, an entire herd of ponies burst through the front of the tavern, in front of which was this buff, enormous pony turned to this player and said, "My name is Inigo Montoya." And the great pony battle. Laura came in at that point and found this tavern full of Klingons, stormtroopers, and a herd of ponies in violent combat, and was wondering, how did we get here?
You're on the Brood Squad.
I am the Brood Squad.
Well, it's funny. Everything you just mentioned, I was just getting ready to ask, what is it as a player to help engage yourself? And I think Tracy just gave a bunch of ways to do that. And Don and Mike, the same type of thing. You got to be willing to take a risk. Yes. And make yourself feel like you are this character. Yeah. What is it that you would do if you were in this situation? And don't quite do it. Or go talk to the Game Master and say, "Look, here's what I want to do." I've even told Game Masters before, if killing my character pushes the story along, then we'll do it. I'll play somebody else later. But I know that there's a point where you have to take a risk if you really want to feel a part of that.
Well, we used to give a lecture called "It Isn't Whether You Live or Die. It's How You Play the Game." And in fact, one of the problems I think that players have in role-playing games is that they are afraid. Mm-hmm. That they're afraid of their character dying because they think that means that they've lost. They're afraid of doing it wrong. They're afraid of rolling the wrong dice. They're afraid of misinterpreting rules. When in fact, you know, that fear, I think, gets in the way of really great play. Mm-hmm. It's when you lose that fear and get lost in the character and are able to make yourself vulnerable enough to risk things like the die rolls and your hit points and for that matter, the death of your character. That's where really great story takes place, is when you're willing to take that risk. And I think that it's fear of losing that actually holds back a lot of players from really getting the kind of enjoyment out of the game that the game offers.
And I've been trying to get my players off of that. There's one time when I was able to achieve it. It's, as a GM, you try to grab the lightning, like when Mike was talking about his, Don was talking about his. Mm-hmm. It happens so rarely that you can get those moments where everybody is so engaged in the storyline that...
But it's that moment that makes all of it.
It does. Mm-hmm. And it's the Dragon Rider.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It's because you commit yourself to care about NPCs.
Yes.
And
not just PCs, NPCs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like when their characters were dying and they had like very little option for it, slowly dying, and their dragons were like doing everything that they can to save their rider, and it was that connection that connection that made such a memorable moment in storytelling.
I almost brought the hat that said "First to fly, last to die."
Yes,
I need to get my foam redone, but
I still have it. Oh yeah, we did for Gen Con. We had like full like flight suits. And
we were in your killer breakfast as the Dragon Riders that year.
I remember it was awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, but it was because we had that connection, and it's like I try to search for that as a GM every single time, and I'm like, why can't I not just...
Well, it's making those connections. I think they're really important. And actually, part of making those connections is why Laura and I did this game that we're doing. The game that we're kickstarting actually September 1st, but we're introducing it here at the convention. We see a kind of a disconnect between hobby gaming and everybody else. And I grew up playing games. I grew up playing games. You know, every holiday there was a new game under the Christmas tree. Every holiday there were new things for us to play as a family through the winter, and we would always break out the games and play them. That was part of the bonding of our family at the time. And to sit around a board game and move the pieces around, you know, and to try to stop my father trying to take over the entire side of the Monopoly board with the
or Don's wife.
Yeah, or Don's. but those were the memories we grew up with, and those were bonding moments for us as a family. And we still play games together as a family. But there seems to be a disconnect between the storytelling games that we have in hobby, mm-hmm. and wonderful games. I'll also say. And our ability to connect with everybody else in the world, with the rest of our families who aren't into the hobby and who don't necessarily connect with our gaming.
I understand that completely. I mean, that was one of when I designed my storytelling system, that was one of my main goals, was I want to engage people in the hobby because... Mm-hmm. There is just such a wealth of experience that you can have that you're not constrained to in video games or in a TV show. You can do whatever you want, you can be whatever you want, and you can engage with people across the table beside you, just mm-hmm. person to person, without like a text or a phone or a computer or anything like that. You're connecting with people personally, and I just felt like role-playing games are just like this other, and everybody else is like, ooh, what's that, until you finally are able to explain that to them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we wanted to do this game. Mm-hmm. We wanted a game that you could teach quickly and play quickly, mm-hmm. and still have an experience with story.
Yeah.
That
it's a crossover.
Yeah, it's like kind of a crossover.
It's like reaching a hand across the table to someone who... Because you can play it with people who are very experienced gamers, mm-hmm. and totally enjoy it and have a different experience, but you can also play it with people who are novice to hobby gaming and will understand it and have an enjoyable experience. It's actually an introduction into hobby gaming for people who aren't used to it.
Yeah, I'm excited to take a look at that. That
yeah, I'd love. Really I'm good. Anxious to actually hear your reflections on it. One of the things that we built into the game. Especially because of the advent of ebooks and deliverable content, is we integrate the ebook into the game, and so the game actually connects with the ebook. The ebook then transmits information to the game, and the information goes back and forth between the two. So the game actually itself is designed in such a way that you can play all kinds of different scenarios with it,
yeah, okay.
Depending on what you put in the ebook and the ebook content.
Huh.
And so, essentially, part of this actually came about because we wanted to do a holiday game. We wanted to do a Christmas game. Mm-hmm. But then it was most appropriately pointed out to us that there's about a 6-week market window for a Christmas game, and then what do you do for the other, you know, 10.5 months of the year? What we realized, though, is that we could take this game and produce it in such a way that you could do a Christmas game, that you could do a Thanksgiving game, that you could do an Independence Day game, that you could do a romance for Valentine's Day, do a romance story for Valentine's Day. You could do a horror story for Halloween, and that the content could be downloadable.
Yes.
As long as the game itself was structured in such a way that it would connect into the ebook and also get information from the ebook as well. And that's essentially the direction that we've taken with this. We wanted a game that where you could tell whatever story you wanted to tell, and play whatever game you wanted to play in a storytelling environment that was easy to play, quick to learn, and frankly, we wanted a game that you could play with 2 to 6 players because we like a bigger group of people around the table.
But there's often times when it's just the two of us, and we want something we could play together.
Yeah. One of the other aspects of this is we want to teach people how to write these.
Okay.
It's one of the seminars we're giving actually here at Gen Con, so that if someone wants to write a steampunk story for Sojourner Tales, that they can do so, and they can provide it on, and we'll provide them space on our website. If they want to write horror, or
science fiction,
or fantasy,
mystery,
noir.
So it's something similar to like what Fiasco has done, where you kind of have an open door to any sort of story. It's just using the game as the storytelling system itself.
The game becomes a storytelling system, but the story itself, in our case, unlike Fiasco, which of course is a, as you go. We actually have 2 modes in the game that we have. The one is basically a pick-a-path mode, which is excellent for families because it's an easy storytelling structured system.
Oh my goodness, that reminds me of the choose your own adventures from my like childhood.
Well, yes, and it is very much that way.
Very much so.
It has that feel to it. And the prototype that we have here, we have a little fantasy story that we tell and it has that wonderful nostalgic feel to it.
So can you like peek ahead and say, "Oh, I don't want that," and go back and?
But it has some very nice balance. The other way to play Sojourner Tales is more like Fiasco, where we actually provide you a story structure the way in similar to what Fiasco does. And then you have a certain period of time, a certain amount of time to tell that part of the story, however you want to interpret it, based on what everybody else has said so far.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And so you make up the story as you go. And all the game then does is provide the basic foundational structure to get you where you need to go.
That's
we're very excited about Sojourner Tales. It's a beautiful game, and the strategy play on the board is excellent. It's easy to learn, but the strategy is relatively complex in terms of its movement. And the storytelling structure in it is an awful lot of fun. So, yeah, I'm anxious to show the game to you guys and see what you think about it. Kickstarter is September 1st, like I say. The website is SojournerTales.com.
We'll put a link up.
Yeah, please put a link up for that. And it's up and running now. It's, you know, contents, we're still putting content up. But, yeah, come and take a look at it and see what it is we've got going over there. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Well, I'm gonna wrap it up here. We've spent the last hour and 15 minutes or so.
I know you. I'd love to just sit and talk to you guys forever, but we've I gotta get up in the morning.
And you know,
there's some sort of convention going on.
There's an activity going on tomorrow, and
it's such a bummer.
Details.
The best 4 days of gaming, the worst 4 days of sleeping.
Amen to that.
I'm going to refer that if you want to hear the last established fact, to link back to the last episode that we had and listen to it, because quite frankly it was long and I don't remember it.
But it was the best 91 minutes of gaming entertainment.
It was. But at the end of this episode, I would like to establish, also with thanking Tracy and Laura for joining us, I'd like to establish that, I was thinking this week as I was at work, and I'm like, man, Gen Con is 2 days away, and it's so exciting, and here it comes, and I posted on my Facebook page that, the slogan of Gen Con is it's the best 4 days in gaming. I think here at the Established Facts, living in Indianapolis, getting to experience this, and seeing kind of what it does to the whole city, I think promptly that Gen Con is literally the best year-long wait in gaming.
Yes.
So I would like to establish from the Established Facts that we are live at Gen Con, the best year-long wait in gaming.
May I establish one other
fact? Absolutely.
I would like to just, in closing, I would like to establish one other fact. As I looked at the program book for this convention, on the page where it looked at the lifetime guests of honor, it said at the top, in memoriam, and it had, of course, Gary Gygax, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But beneath that, it shows Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. There's no distinction. I would like to establish the fact that In Memoriam is still premature in our case.
It's either that, or you are the first publisher of the In Space, game, or and we have the first dead person on our establishment. We're just breaking records all over the place.
Yes, we are.
Zombie Tracy Hickman?
Zombie Tracy Hickman. I think that's solid stuff for... that's some solid stuff for killer breakfast when you get there.
Yes, and...
And then?
Yeah, there you go. If you ask what your name is in killer breakfast, my name is and... Thanks, guys. Right, thanks
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good con.
Tuning out.
Please visit us at www.theestablishedfacts.com and our Facebook page, facebook.com/theestablishedfacts. If you would like to support us by buying some merchandise, visit cafepress.com/castingrobot.